This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
It's Friday. You know what that means around here. It's time to make sense of the biggest local and statewide stories in our weekly news recap.
Two migrant families were moved yesterday after multiple curfew violations at the old Super 8 Motel, now a migrant shelter in Rogers Park.
In just a few weeks, thousands of CPS students are heading back to the classroom, but how they're getting there may soon change. The district is trying to tackle a bus driver shortage.
Dr. Allison Arwoody is gone as the city's top public health official.
Mayor Brandon Johnson has picked Chicago Police Counterterrorism Chief Larry Snelling to be Chicago's new police superintendent.
Here to dive deep into those stories and much more is Chalkbeat Chicago Bureau Chief Becky Vivi, Chicago-based Axios reporter Monica Eng, and Chicago Tribune state government reporter Dan Petrella. We start today with some City Hall news that kicked off the week. Mayor Johnson decided to go with a CPD insider to lead the police department. Monica, tell us about Larry Snelling.
Larry Snelling is a born and bred Chicagoan. He's from Englewood. He's been on the force for a long time. He's led the counterterrorism force, and he's developed the department's current force training model around best practices and constitutional policing. But he's also an insider. So, you know, there's this pendulum swing. Let's go with an outsider. They can fix the problems. Let's go with an insider. They'll have the, you know, the support of the rank and file. And so we're back to insider, and he's with the program. He's quoting some of the Brandon Johnson catchphrases of competence, compassion, and collaboration.
The three C's.
The three C's. I love, you know, it's almost like Soul of Chicago. We're going to be hearing that a lot. But I would say the three things he's really going to struggle with are safety, reform, and morale. And those are sometimes at odds with each other. You know, how do you, like, be on the side of everybody who's, like, it needs to be safer, but how do you, like, shore up the morale of a demoralized force? And how do you keep completing the consent decree?
And what's the general reaction to this choice?
Well, maybe the reason why he was chosen is because really nobody kind of hates this. You know, even from the right, he's not getting a lot of flack. So I think he may just be confirmed.
Yeah, from the FOP?
Yeah. They're not mad about it. Progressive reformers. Not even the conservative alders have piped up.
And it seems also like the rank and file do like him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an impossible job, though.
Yeah. Kind of like the mayor is an impossible job. But he still needs city council approval.
Right. That looks like it's going to come, but we'll see.
Well, Mayor Johnson also did something major. He may have chosen an insider to be Chicago's top cop, but he decided to get rid of the city's top doc. Becky, you were on Reset earlier in the week talking about this story, but catch us up on the drama around Dr. Allison Arwoody.
Right. It's such an end of an era because she became this sort of household name in the last few years when COVID came upon us, and she was similar to Dr. Fauci as on like a local level. People really looked to her and her weekly Facebook chats to provide guidance around COVID. But, of course, she was sort of on the side of Mayor Lori Lightfoot when it came to school reopening. And Brandon Johnson, the CTU, really clashed on that issue with her. Drama last Friday, she was told, you are no longer a city employee. And she took to X, formerly known as Twitter, to say that, you know, she didn't get to say goodbye to her staff and that she thought it was really problematic how the departure was handled. Obviously, new mayor comes in. I think most officials in those positions know that their job's no longer guaranteed and there's some sort of changing of the guard that occurs. And I think she knew that that was potentially coming, given their differences. And he said it on the campaign trail, of course. But what is interesting here, too, will be the number two is also resigned and I believe is done at the end of the month. And so the number three person who's not a doctor is, going to be interim. And Johnson hasn't really given any clues as to who he will pick to lead that department at a time when we still have a lot of federal COVID money being spent down, at least in the school system and at the public health department. And that department has gone through a lot of changes. And so where that department goes under his leadership will be is still a big question mark. And I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, and she's also gone on a little bit of a press tour this week.
She has, yes.
She told Mariah that, you know, she'd never met with him.
Yes.
And any time the press says
Mariah here at Mariah Wolfel. Yeah.
And every time the press has asked Mayor Johnson, did you even ever meet with her? Always deflected.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he did quote Tupac this week. Realize.
Yeah, and you know, she did. Again, she has not been a media shy person, so she did go on her, you know, press tour and like she said a couple of times, I think to NBC5 and even to Mariah WBEZ, that her issue is not that she's gone; it's more that like the way it was done is maybe going to send signals to other people who might be interested in the job that you know, that's not an appealing position to be in.
The timing was weird too politically because he, like you said, telegraphed during the campaign that he was going to do it, but then he waits three months and then he doesn't have a replacement on hand to say, I'm getting rid of her because I'm putting this person in her place. So it was all just handled very, very oddly.
And again, he told Mariah Wolfel day after the election, I look forward to sitting down with her and talking to her. So what happened to the sit down? I mean, you could invite her to lunch.
Realize that's what happened. But Dan, you know, she was this voice of reason and reassurance for many Chicagoans when we were on lockdown. Of course, a lot of people did not agree with her recommendations. You know, we were a divided, maybe not as divided as the country, but there was division on masking and dining and schools. But how do you think this decision by the mayor to can her is going to go over with the public or is going to continue to go over with the public?
You know, it's interesting. I think that, you know, she is a popular figure and she didn't get to leave of her own accord like Dr. Azike on the state level did, where she left for another job at a time that was convenient for her.
Or
you know?
Any of the other commissioners.
Right. Yeah. This sort of unceremonious dismissal, I think, you know, will raise questions about Johnson's leadership, the way he's handling these appointments, and again, you know, whether he will live up to his words, like when he says he's going to meet with people and doesn't, or apparently doesn't.
Well, and I would say also, but before the COVID pandemic hit, progressives had some issues with Arwoody and her stance on the closure of mental health clinics under former Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and so I think Brandon Johnson's supporters often were sort of you know, wanting her out for those reasons. They had nothing to do with the pandemic. But I do think there are questions, you know, pre-pandemic, too. The public health commissioner was not, like, it was a tiny sort of back, small department.
Public health.
But it was a small department in City Hall, and it wasn't considered one of these top picks that the mayor came in and made.
Yeah, and so, you know, Dan, a lot of people think that this is just another example of Johnson being beholden to the teachers union, but I saw, you know, immediately progressives were putting out their own tweets, you know, Saturday morning saying why they thought Arwoody was trash. But is the perception of the CTU going to overtake any other criticisms that progressives might have had about her?
Yeah, you know, I think that label is going to be on the mayor until he, if he at some point does something where he gets out of step with the CTU. I think every decision that he makes is going to be viewed through that lens, especially if it's a decision that aligns with the point of view of the teachers union.
And especially if he doesn't explain, like if he said, oh, you know, Cranes is positing that this was all over the mental health clinics. And if he said that, then it wouldn't look like he's beholden to the CTU. But he's not explaining why she went.
So Becky and I have already been talking about, are we ready for Chicago Public Schools to start on Monday as parents of children in CPS? So suburbs have already started, many going back this week. How are things going?
I mean, so far we haven't heard a whole bunch of, it seems like things are pretty smooth sailing and also very much back to normal. Last year we were still under some of the emergency orders, so there were COVID guidelines that the state was sending out to schools, though most schools were going back with sort of this recommendation of masking and some limited quarantining if you were, you know, positive for COVID. A couple of things I know Chicago Public Schools has signaled that they're getting rid of their in-school testing. We know downstate that a lot of the testing that SHIELD was doing for suburban districts, they closed that site in June. They're not doing that anymore. So, I think things are off to back to almost like a new normal start.
And with CPS on Monday, thousands of students will not have bus service. What is going on?
Yes. So this is a continuing issue that really started about 3 years ago, 2 years ago. There has been a bus driver shortage, but piled on top of that, Chicago Public Schools has had difficulty sort of realigning and getting students assigned to bus routes, and they've changed up how they've approached it. And earlier this month, they sent essentially a notice to families and to parents that if you hadn't requested transportation as of a very early date in August, you weren't gonna be guaranteed it. You weren't gonna be getting it. And they have said that they are prioritizing students with disabilities, students who have individualized education plans, IEPs, for those services, because there's something like, I think it's 8,000 that they say just won't have bus service. They're not extending bus service to magnet and selective enrollment students who live a certain distance away from home, in order to prioritize students with disabilities.
And unhoused.
Students who are entitled to it by law. That's correct. So students who are unhoused. And I anticipate that we'll be pretty busy Monday with, I think there will be hiccups. I'll just say that.
One thing that I've heard about, you know, this not having bus service, particularly for a magnet and selective enrollment, is this going to broaden inequities in the school system? I hadn't thought about it that way, but have you heard that or put any thought into what lack of busing means for students from other neighborhoods going to?
Well, I mean, that also gets into a broader question about the system we've set up in Chicago, where a lot of people participate in some form of choice, whether that's a magnet or a selective test in school, or they choose a charter, or they choose a school that's different than their neighborhood school. Busing's obviously, like I said, not guaranteed for all of those situations. But if you are not, you know, it could lead to inequities, because if you don't have the ability to drive your kid a couple miles away from your home twice a day, that is a challenge, and it makes you make a different decision, a decision that, you know, would maybe be not the best school for your child, but you're having to make it because of logistics.
Monica?
A couple of other things we're looking at as school starting on Monday at Axios is that for the first time in recent memory, the mayor is sending his kids back to school in CPS. And, you know, I think that shows a little more skin in the game. This is the first year in 18 years we're not sending a kid to CPS.
I know, I didn't want to get you emotional So when was the – okay, so
I looked backward really far, and I did not find like a single anybody.
Harold Washington didn't have kids.
No?
Nope.
Jane Byrne didn't.
Jane Byrne didn't send her kids.
Michael Lildanick.
Lildanick didn't. The Dailies Richard all went Catholic.
J. Daly did not.
They went Catholic.
And M. Daly did not.
Yeah. And Lori,
way back, and I started to get to the point where I'm like, I don't even know if these people had kids.
Where did Cermak's kids go to school?
It's possible. That's why you have to say in recent memory, because it is possible. At the turn of the century.
That's a stunning thing to say out loud. I mean, I think we must have known it intrinsically, but it's like, wow, that.
Yeah,
I reported that right after he was elected.
Yeah.
He says it in person a lot.
We have an editor who edits the Axios Chicago newsletter out of town, and he put what and he's like, is that true? And I said it is in recent memory at least.
Yeah. Before we get to the break, another update on the migrant crisis. Two families and their children were removed from a Rogers Park shelter because they missed a curfew. Monica, what are those details?
Well, they missed an 11 o'clock curfew, and they were told, you know, can't break the rules. They said they've seen other people break the curfews, and so they've been trying to find other housing for them. They wanted to make sure it's housing that accepts families. And, you know, we did a migrant story this week that had a stunning fact that, you know, we have 13,000 migrants here, according to the city, but only about a third have been sent by Greg Abbott. So I dug into, like, well, who keeps sending them to Chicago when we are just bursting at the seams? Why not send them to cities that have a little more capacity right now?
What did you find?
I found that it's NGOs in Texas, including Catholic Charities, and Denver. Denver has gotten more than 14,000 migrants, but guess how many are still in the city? About 500. They hand out bus tickets to Chicago and train tickets.
Who is the...
At first it was the governor, and then Lori Lightfoot said, cut it out. Hey, we're all Democrats. Why are you doing this? So he promised in January to cut it out, and now it's Denver Department of Human Services. They confirmed with me. They said, hey, if the migrants want to go there, we'll give them a ticket.
So they're saying the migrants want to come to Chicago?
Yeah. That's what they said. And I said, have you shown them the pictures of our police station floors? I went to the 14th District this week, and my heart was broken. I mean, toddlers having, you know, just lying down on the floor, and just you can hardly walk in there because it's all blankets on the floor. And this is not uncommon in all of our districts.
We turn now to state politics. Dan, Governor Pritzker signed some 40 bills into law last Friday. Let's start with the new law aimed at gun manufacturers.
That's right. The bill aimed at gun manufacturers sort of tries to put guardrails around what they can do in their advertising. It opens them up to civil liabilities. And almost as soon as the bill was signed, a lawsuit was filed challenging it on First Amendment grounds. This is yet another issue in which guns are related, where the state is in court, this time fighting on First Amendment grounds as opposed to Second Amendment grounds. It'll be interesting to see how the courts deal with these First Amendment arguments, basically saying that this new state law is restricting the free speech rights of gun manufacturers to advertise their products as they see fit.
What were some other laws that jumped out for you?
Sure. You know, one of the ones that got a lot of attention in Springfield this past spring allowed businesses to choose to open gender-neutral multiple occupancy bathrooms. A couple of years ago, the state made a law saying that any single occupancy bathroom should be gender-neutral. This is not a mandate, but an option for businesses who are interested in providing gender-neutral multi-occupancy bathrooms to be able to do it. The guidelines for how it would work. It got a lot of attention from folks on the far right, who made all sorts of wild claims about, you know, it forcing people to do this or that sort of thing. The governor signed it into law last week.
Listen, when I have to go or my kid has to go and there's a single occupancy male stall, you just go right in.
Yeah, it's just amazing how much attention and angst and fury there is over this. You know, you had one state senator from the Quad Cities area saying that, you know, if he was in the bathroom with his 10-year-old daughter and a man came in to use it, he would, I'm not even sure if I can say this word on the radio, but beat the piss out of them. I was actually on the Senate floor in the press box when that comment was made, and everybody's jaw in the room kind of dropped. And just the level of rhetoric over it is pretty
Oh, you could
amazing.
Lock the door, and why would you even be in there with your 10-year-old daughter?
Yeah.
In a single occupancy stall.
Yeah. But
it's just this hysteria around bathrooms are just so political now.
Right, yeah. And the new law lays out the way the stalls have to be configured, how many, you know, fixtures there have to be, all that kind of stuff. Just the really nuts and bolts of how it would work. And it was interesting to see it become such a heated partisan issue.
And he also signed a bill that promotes salary transparency. What are the details of that?
That's right. Employers with, I believe, 15 or more employees are going to be required to post pay scales for jobs when they advertise them. Starting in 2025, this is aimed at actually letting people know what they might be paid when they apply for a job. I think any of us who have, applied for jobs know that it can be kind of this blind process where the employer is kind of trying to figure out, well, like, how much have you made at your previous jobs? And you're trying to figure out, like, well, how much did you pay the person who did this job before me? And this is supposed to really address particularly gender and race-based pay gaps that I think we all know exist. I will say that I know they exist within our newsroom because our union did a study showing that they exist within our newsroom. So I think this is aimed at hopefully addressing a lot of those issues on a statewide level.
And so it's businesses with 15 or more employees. They have to include that, and that law takes effect in 2025.
That's correct.
Monica, your colleague Justin Kaufman wrote about this new law. Illinois is the first state to mandate compensation for child social media influencers.
Yeah, so like if you have a Honey Boo Boo type child who's super cute and everybody's watching them on YouTube and TikTok, you better set aside some money for that kid and stop stealing it from him. I mean, there are big questions about whether you should be exploiting your child for social media money, but at least now they're supposed to get paid when they turn 18 when you put aside this money.
At 50%.
Yeah.
Interesting.
What do you think of that, Becky?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, like you said, there are a lot of questions about exploitation, and certainly, like, if you have a child who is doing what is arguably paid work now in this world and in this economy, you have people making all kinds of money on social media. And I mean, I think it's fair. We've seen these proposals come up in other states, but to see Illinois pass a law, it's pretty incredible. And I'd be curious to read more of the details. I didn't see like all of the nuts
and bolts. Yeah, and the fact that we're the first, that's super interesting. Do we have more cute kids doing cute things on and what about cats and dogs?
Well, right, and it's interesting because you would think, I mean, I think California and New York are other like big cities where people, you know, you have an entertainment industry and more of these people.
But we're not talking about child stars. Like so many people are trying to get.
No, I know, but I mean like when you think about influencer culture, it's still very much like based in and around
people who used to be on
reality TV become influencers. Not that those are the minors, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, that little boy Ryan who sits there and opens gifts, I don't know where he lives.
Right.
He makes
I don't know. Exactly.
And I think some parents are bank. I mean, so many people think my kid is so cute. Maybe my child can go viral or do something. And it's a small number, but. We had an expert on earlier this week. You know, this is the first step because we're in a new landscape.
Exactly.
Just making sure that the kids are getting legal questions
about as influencing and these social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram become the space. They're the new, you know, ABC, Full House, Child Star, you know.
Right, and we see how a lot of child
cable
stars
television, yeah,
turn out.
Yeah, so it's like if that's the new version and it's Wild West right now, not regulated.
Macaulay Culkin, here I come.
And we've all heard those horror stories where like kids who were like child stars in traditional Hollywood had all the money taken from them and they become adults and there's nothing left, like their parents have totally exploited them.
And we're starting to hear a little bit about that with social media.
Yeah.
You know, mom bloggers who their kids are speaking out about having been written about, you know, not the, you know, mom influencers who have used their kids. So, I think this is just the first step in what could continue to be debated and regulated. But there's another child bill that the governor signed, and this is for 4-H and Future Farmers America Club members. Tell us about that, Becky.
Yeah, so this is a bill that allows those students to attend events and do their sort of FFA work study, if you will, agricultural work, and get excused absences, which is pretty interesting. I know, like, broadly beyond just FFA, this question of absences has become more a little bit heightened post-pandemic because you had skyrocketing rates of chronic absenteeism and you have kids. I mean, even in one of the stories I read about this bill passing, you know, and of course they were missing school to go attend FFA events. But yeah, you do have a lot of kids who are missing school for other reasons. But this bill would allow them to have excused absences for those types of sort of work, service, learning opportunities, agricultural opportunities.
And this bill, as well as the social media influencer bill, these were both bipartisan.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
just wanted to note that. But he did, the Governor Pritzker did veto some legislation. Dan, environmentalists are cheering a veto involving a moratorium on nuclear power plants.
That's right. And this was a little bit of a surprise. The governor had spoken during the spring about this proposal and said that he was somewhat supportive of the idea of these sort of smaller modular nuclear reactors that are sort of in development right now that one of the ways people are thinking about using them is putting them in places where coal or natural gas plants shut down to provide sort of more, some would argue, more stable power than wind or solar can without the carbon output of a fossil fuel burning plant. But what the governor said is that a final change that was made to the bill before it was passed really opened the door to reactors of any size being built in Illinois, which he is not supportive of. He worries that that would lead to companies who build them, Constellation Energy is the one who owns all the nuclear plants in Illinois right now, getting massive government subsidies to build these plants. There's a new nuclear plant that opened in Georgia, I believe, earlier this year that ran billions of dollars over cost in like 7 years beyond schedule. So there are concerns about if we're going to reopen the door to nuclear power in Illinois, to new nuclear power in Illinois, that we do it in a way that is protective of public safety.
We're going to turn to some tragic news. This morning is the funeral of the 9-year-old child, Sarah B. Medina, who was killed in front of her Portage Park home on August 5th. A law that went into effect July 1st is supposed to pay funeral expenses for murdered children. But Sun-Times columnist Rich Miller raised concerns about the law's lack of funding. Monica, can you fill us in?
Sure, that the law was passed last year, but it had the caveat that it was subject to appropriation. I guess a lot of people thought, well, of course they've appropriated the money for it. Of course it was in the February budget, but it was not. And so will the funeral expenses be paid? That's unclear. Department of Human Services says that they're going to fix it. They're going to find the money and they can retroactively pay it back. But somehow this slipped through the cracks in terms of funding. But, there, you know, as Rich Miller points out, there's a lot of legislation that gets passed that's subject to appropriation. And somehow you're like, OK, well, rubber's going to hit the road. How do we pay for this? And nobody's quite sure.
But he also wrote in his column that, that this isn't adequately engaged in the budget making process. Dan, what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, like Monica said, there are lots of programs that get created that lawmakers, champion. They think they're good ideas, and then they just never are able to find the money for. There's one that comes to mind that was created like a decade or so ago, a state-level gang crime witness protection program that until, I think, this past year was never funded. So it's one thing in covering Springfield that you have to keep an eye out for is where the rhetoric matches the reality, and it doesn't always.
Look for that little caveat in there. I covered a mental health bill that we all know mental health for students is really, we're having a crisis, and they said yes, we definitely should give more money for mental health for college students, but that was never funded until this year.
And Illinois officials say the state will cover funeral expenses of a migrant child who died on a bus journey from Texas. Becky, what are the details?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a horrible, horrible news story is all I can say is this young 3-year-old, I believe it was, on the bus coming from Texas, suffered a cardiac arrest and died. And the state has said that they will step in and provide the funding for the service, which I guess is taking place over the border in Indiana, but given the sort of extreme sort of sensitive nature of the situation, they felt it was right to step in and provide support for that. I don't know. It was a very difficult one to read. I was crying reading it. So,
Dan, jurors are hearing testimony in the trial of a mannequin aide, including secretly recorded conversations.
Yes, we've been hearing a lot of secretly recorded conversations airing in the Dirksen Federal Courthouse this spring and summer. This is the trial of Tim Mapes, who was sort of Mike Madigan's right-hand man in many things. He was his longtime chief of staff. He was the clerk of the Illinois House, and he was the executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. He was ousted in a sexual harassment allegation. An inspector general report came out that he had sort of created a hostile work environment. He was known for his very closely guarding of Mike Madigan's time, not letting people anywhere near the speaker, sort of being very hard-nosed about, as people like to say, keeping the trains running on time. And he is accused of lying to a federal grand jury who is investigating Madigan. And I believe today, actually, the prosecutors just wrapped up their case. We've heard all sorts of testimony from Springfield insiders about the kind of things that those of us who cover the state and cover Springfield wish we could hear, the conversations that are going on behind closed doors, the way power is sort of wielded and used within those inner circles in Springfield. It's been very fascinating. I wish I could sit in the courtroom and hear it all, as opposed to just having to read my colleagues and others' excellent coverage of the trial. But it's been very fascinating to watch.
And earlier this week, former President Trump, along with 18 other people, were indicted in Georgia. And two folks from the Chicago area are on that indictment list. Monica, what do we know about them?
Well, one of them worked with the musical star formerly known as Kanye, that's Ye, and R. Kelly. And what did she tweet out about someone's being crucified, like...
Like, yeah,
yes, she quoted,
told me that. Working with R. Kelly and Ye has taught her about how people, I don't have it in front of me, just
being a crisis manager, media.
Yeah, and in the words of Ye, who she, deeply respects,
they were trying to crucify her like Christ, the phrase.
Wow. Yeah.
But she and this Lutheran pastor, Stephen Clifgard Lee, from a church in Orland Park, are accused of trying to influence the testimony of Ruby Freeman, who is an election judge down in Fulton County, Georgia, who many of us saw testify before the January 6th committee. Just surprised to see these names pop up in the indictment.
Yeah.
It really shows you how, I think, widespread at least all this allegedly was.
And the publicist's name is Trevion Kuti, so along with that Orland Park pastor. And then we know the man who set fire to a Peoria Planned Parenthood was sentenced this week. Becky, what happened there?
Right, so this was an incident that occurred a couple of days after Governor Pritzker signed a law that protected reproductive health care legislation in Illinois and protected out-of-state abortion seekers who, are now in states where abortion is illegal. And this person threw flames into a Planned Parenthood and it burnt, and that center hasn't been able to reopen. They're saying it may reopen it early next year, but he was sentenced to 10 years and ordered him to pay close to $1.5 million for that act of arson.
Changing gears here, the Air and Water Show is roaring into town this weekend. We can actually hear them from Navy Pier as we speak, but the big thing going on is the Illinois State Fair. This is day 8, I believe. Republicans had their day yesterday. Democrats made the rounds on Wednesday for the Governor's Day at the fair. Let's listen to what Governor J.B. Pritzker had to say.
We're the party that stands up for workers' rights. We're the party that stands up for human rights. We're the party that stands up for civil rights and voting rights and reproductive rights.
Dan, you've been to the state fair, right? Set the scene for us.
I have, yes. It's always a very hot but fun time in Springfield. I was a local reporter in Springfield at the State Journal Register for a few years earlier in my career, so I spent a lot of time out at the fairgrounds. But the political days are really interesting, amid the backdrop of the Ferris wheel and carnival rides and the giant slide and corn dogs and all that. You have the contrast of the two parties here in Illinois, and really right now I don't think the contrast could be starker than it is. You have the Democrats, who control all statewide offices, 14 of 17 congressional seats, both U.S. Senate seats. They have record or near-record supermajorities in both houses of the legislature. They have a 5-2 advantage on the state Supreme Court. And then you have the Republican Party that's really sort of trying to find its footing here in Illinois, and it's seen its base of power in the collar counties around Cook County just completely erode over the past couple decades, with the governor speaking to reproductive rights there. A big part of that we've seen recently is the maybe more moderate, middle of road suburban female voters moving to the Democratic Party, where maybe in the past They would have supported Republicans on fiscal issues and things like that. And in these non-election year years at the fair, it's really a chance for the parties to kind of set what their message is going to be going into next year's election. And we saw from the Democrats, they're going to be talking about Donald Trump a lot. They're going to be talking about abortion and reproductive rights a lot. And on the Republican side, it's a little less clear what exactly their strategy is going to be. They may try to paint Democrats as being too extreme on abortion. I'm not sure how well that will sell. They also will be trying to talk a lot about Mike Madigan because he is set to go on trial at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse next spring. So that will be interesting to see how that factors in elections next year here in Illinois, because they've had sort of a mixed record of trying to use Madigan against the Democrats in the past.
The big draw at the fair is not the politicians talking about their agenda, but the deep fried delicacies. I've never been to an Illinois state fair. I have been to Minnesota when I was a reporter. Well, I didn't cover it, but I felt like I had to go try these deep fried delicacies. Dan, what have been some of your favorites over the years?
You know, my personal favorite is kind of boring. The one I'm always sure to get is a, I'm going to make sure I pronounce the name right, but Vose's Corn Dog. It's actually not too far from the director's lawn where the politicians do all their
freshly
speeches.
Dipped.
That's right. That's the thing I'm sure never to miss. But I do enjoy, you know, a deep fried Snickers or a funnel cake or something along those lines every now and then. There's also a booth there from 17th Street Barbecue, which is actually down in Southern Illinois in Murfreesboro. But it's an excellent barbecue place, and they have a booth at the fair that I like to stop by too when I get down there.
Have you tried the deep fried Oreo? They have those.
Monica, yeah. You have probably eaten everything at a state fair and written about it.
Last year I did a big story. I ate a ton, but I had the deep fried horseshoe,
the classic sandwich?
Yeah, that's cheese sauce and fries and burger wrapped in a tortilla, deep fried.
Oh my God.
Flaming Hot Cheetos cheeseburger.
Did you eat the whole thing, Monica?
I shared it with my partner and his son because I had to eat 10 of these. And then another
oh my
one,
God.
They take a block of Swiss cheese and they dip it in a rye batter and then they deep fry it. And it's like deep fried rye outside the Swiss cheese. The rainbow grilled cheese.
Okay, wait. We gotta back up. So I have a tummy ache hearing that, but how was it?
It was actually good. You put a lot
actually
of...
good.
Yeah.
The horseshoe or the... Well, which one are we talking about?
The horseshoe.
The horseshoe. I love a horseshoe.
But it was deep...
I've eaten many horseshoes, but I've never had one deep fried. I'm going to have to go back.
Oh, yeah, you got
to
go back.
Wrapped in a tortilla, so like a burrito?
Yeah, it's like a horseshoe egg roll.
Oh, my God.
Burrito, and then deep fried.
But the size of like a small...
Yeah, huge.
Dog.
Like a small baby. And then candy melons, where they take watermelon, and then they pour lots of sweet syrup in it. That was interesting, too.
Good interesting, bad interesting.
Probably too sweet for me, but interesting nonetheless.
What about the deep-fried Twinkie?
Deep-fried Twinkie, you know, they're kind of a dime a dozen.
Oh, okay.
It's like deep-fried stuff and then like the soft, molten, cakey center with the cream.
Anything else that was...
I like the rainbow grilled cheese sandwich because
what is a rainbow?
Okay, so they put a whole bunch of food coloring on the cheese. They put it in there, and then you pull it apart, and then you have a rainbow of cheese, and you have like one piece of bread on this side, another half of the sandwich on this side, and a rainbow in front of you. I can send you guys. I can tweet out my.
Wait, what gives it the color?
Food coloring.
Food coloring. Okay.
Yeah, artificial food coloring.
Okay. Well, if anyone is their stomach is rumbling because they want to try these things, the state fair wraps up on Sunday, so this is your weekend. We're gonna move from Springfield to the south side of Chicago, where the University of Chicago agreed to pay more than $13 million. For colluding with other universities to limit financial aid. It's a bit confusing. Becky, can you help make sense of it?
I don't know that I can.
No, I'll try to jump
okay.
in.
Yeah, Monica
so,
might be
so
able
they,
to.
So they got together with a bunch of Ivy League universities to say, okay, this is going to be our formula. And unfortunately, that formula is not supposed to take into account people's ability to pay, but the charges that it did. So if someone's on a waiting list and they don't need as much financial aid as the guy who's also on the waiting list, the charges are that they will give it to the person who can actually pay more of it. And that's why it's a problem for them to do that.
And there was other news involving the University of Chicago, this time the hospital, where apparently a fight broke out in the emergency room.
Yeah, it was a fight involving many people, and some of the workers got hurt and injured in it. They didn't find any weapons, but, it just highlights that we did an Axios story showing this month that being a healthcare worker is actually one of the most dangerous jobs in the nation. Mm-hmm. The injuries for them have gone up every year. And that was actually one of the complaints of the Laredo workers who were striking earlier this month at Laredo Hospital, saying that, there's just not enough safety around it. So they said they're going to beef up security around there to deal with these issues. But what our story said was that during COVID, just more and more healthcare workers were involved in injuries on the job because of violence.
Over in West Suburban DuPage County, more than 50 former patients are coming forward about an OBGYN. They allege he was drunk on the job and acted inappropriately. Let's hear what former patient Elizabeth Gudella had to say.
I just feel really bad for my previous self and that I didn't register how awful it was. And there's just been a lot of different scenarios that he put me into that are very wrong. So coming forward is just helpful to me, to these women behind me, and then anybody that this is happening to.
So yeah, that was they've five new lawsuits were filed against doctor, gynecologist, and obstetrician Dr. Vernon Cannon and his former employer, the Dooley Healthcare, formerly DuPage Medical Group, that he engaged in inappropriate behavior with them. You know, some said that he commented on their tattoos and then wanted to show his, that he was inebriated. They for the record deny all wrongdoing. And they said that alleged behavior is inconsistent with their medical practice, but they're not allowed to say more because of the lawsuit. But that number of women, it's hard to ignore.
And Cannon left his practice.
That's right.
In 2020.
Yeah.
And more lawsuits for Northwestern University this week, Becky.
Yeah. So the three former assistant baseball coaches are suing Northwestern, basically alleging retaliation for their being let go and that the head coach was a known bully, which is just interesting, too. I think it's kind of yet another case stemming from Northwestern's athletic department. Obviously, we have some of the allegations from former players in the on the football team.
Yes.
And so I think really it raises some questions about what sort of systems are in place in that athletic department or were in place in that athletic department for people to feel like it was a safe and healthy work environment. And, sports, locker rooms, who knows what's going on. But if you have a coach who's a known bully, I mean, we'll see how this one winds its way through courts and what comes of it. But
and a longtime former journalism professor at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, made national headlines this week. Dan, you had a class with Eric Meyer. Fill us in.
I did. He is the publisher of a newspaper in Kansas called the Marion Record, and I had him, almost 20 years ago now, for a graphics and design class, which was notoriously one of the toughest, if not the toughest class in the journalism program at U of I. And when I saw these headlines, I was just like, man, they picked a fight with the wrong guy. He was a really good teacher, a very tough teacher. He would tell you at the beginning of class that each semester that if he caught you in the computer lab during class time on something that was not classwork, he would unplug your computer. And he was not lying because I had that happen to me on at least one occasion. But basically, reporters at his paper had gotten a tip about a restaurateur in the town who allegedly had gotten a DUI and was still driving without a license. They were looking into it. They hadn't actually published a story on it. I believe had decided not to publish a story on it when police came in and took records, computers, pretty much everything from their newspaper office. Professor Meyer's mother ended up, who was also co-publisher of the paper, ended up passing away. He believes at least partially due to the stress from the situation. But it has since been found that the police acted improperly. Their materials were returned, and now the Kansas Bureau of Investigations is looking into the situation.
Well, that's all that we have with our panel today. We've had Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune, Becky Vivi of Chalkbeat Chicago, Monica Eng of Axios. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of Reset was produced by Andrea Guthman and edited by Linnea Dominic and Brenda Ruiz. That'll do it for Reset. I'm Natalie Moore, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend and look out for a bonus podcast tomorrow morning.